So last time, which was I think first or second week in December, last time we were in chapter 20 of John's Gospel, the resurrection appearances of Jesus. In chapter 20, John's Gospel reaches its climax, really. Thomas meets Jesus the week after his resurrection and makes that great statement of who Christ is. My Lord and my God. Stop doubting and believe. Jesus had told Thomas, and he does. His eyes are wide open. The darkness that has been a theme running through John has gone. And after that great statement of faith of Thomas's, Jesus says to him, you know, you've believed because you've seen me, and blessed are those who've not seen and yet have believed. Us. And we discovered the purpose there at the end of the chapter, the purpose that we've been referring to all the time as we've gone through the book, reminding ourselves that this is why John is writing. Jesus did many other miraculous signs which aren't recorded here, but these are written so that you would believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's what it's about. The importance of belief in the death and resurrection of Jesus, to see that Jesus is God and that his death on the cross takes the penalty that our guilt deserves, and that this belief in him brings life in his name, new life, rich life, full life. Because of the resurrection, everything is changed. There is a sense in which the book could end there. Sometimes, if you're reading a whodunit, once you get to that grand unveiling where you discover who did it, that's it. But sometimes you get a chapter which kind of rounds it all off and ties up the loose ends and explains how people's lives pan out. And chapter 21 is the conclusion. It ties up the loose ends. It rounds off the book. It balances out, actually, with stuff that's been going on earlier. So we're told this event happens afterwards. Well, we don't know precisely when afterwards is. We know that it's sometime between the time Thomas meets Jesus, 1 week after the resurrection, and the ascension of Jesus, 40 days after the resurrection. But we do know where it happens. It happens back in Galilee. Disciples, of course, have been told, it's recorded for us in some of the other Gospels, told to go to Galilee and that he would meet them there. There's a lovely symmetry, though, here. We're back to Galilee, which is really where the narrative began. We started in chapter 1. Funny that. We started in chapter 1, where 5 of the 7 people who appear in this story first met Jesus. We find ourselves by the Sea of Galilee, eating bread and fish again. Echoing for us chapter 6, where they sit down by the sea and Jesus feeds the 5,000. There are echoes too of what goes on in Luke 5, an earlier miraculous event where Jesus provides a fish to them when they've not been able to catch any themselves. The time when he called them and told them they would become fishers of men. So the 7 of them are together. They're at a loose end. It's been a difficult time. It's been a demanding time. You're not quite sure, really, what's going on. Jesus is risen, amazing, but he seems to be coming and going. And so Peter says, well, while I'm waiting, I'm off fishing. And the others say, well, we're coming too. Commentators have spilt miles and miles of ink on whether or not the disciples were in terrible rebellion against God by going fishing, because they've gone back to the old thing And others are kind of, well, right and kind of staunchly defend them and how they were, this is exactly what they should have been doing because they were waiting for Jesus. And I think we don't read too much in it. They're at a loose end. They're fishermen. Let's go fishing. It's a very natural account. Sometimes the Bible's got all these strange stories in it, hasn't it? Miraculous events, enormous historical events, battles and kings. Now, of course the Bible is unveiling, but it's that most enormous story, that greatest of stories, how we might know God. What His purpose is for every man and woman and boy and girl. But here we are seeing just ordinary everyday folk, you know? And we're told about the people who were there. There are seven of them. Simon, Thomas, called Didymus, that was the same Thomas that met Jesus then on the second occasion. Nathanael, who comes from Cana in Galilee. The sons of Zebedee, two other disciples, we're not sure their names, they're not recorded for us. It's interesting, we're told that the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John. Of course, one of those is John, our author. This is a first-person account. This is an eyewitness statement. That's what it says at the end of the chapter. This is the disciple who testified to these things and who wrote them down. This is real. This is authentic. Did you notice when we were reading through and the bit where Peter jumps out of the boat and goes off to meet Jesus and the rest of them all in the boat still dealing with the fish? And maybe you're like me and you think, well, I wonder what... Tell me about the meeting of Simon and Jesus, because that's the interesting bit. And the author just keeps on telling you about what's going on in the boat, verse 8 to 10. But why? Well, because it's an eyewitness statement. And the author who's writing it was in the boat, and he wasn't on the shore, and so he tells it as it was. It's just... Don't miss the authenticity of this. The report of the fact that it's a fire of charcoal, and there's bread and there's 153 fish. Do you hear the ring of the eyewitness writing this? It's a reliable account. We can have confidence as we read it. Well, there you go. They go fishing. I'm off to fish. Okay, we'll come with you. I don't know if you've ever been fishing. I have, on a handful of occasions, been fishing. Never caught anything. No, but these are professional fishermen. Five of these guys are fishermen. That's what they do. They fish. The last 3 years they've been doing some fishing, but mostly they've been following Jesus. But well, they've been fishing. I mean, fishing is like riding a bike, isn't it? I mean, obviously different, but you don't forget fishing. This is their patch. This is their bit of water. They know. So they go out in the night time, which was the right time for catching fish, and they know this stuff, and they fish all night long, and they have caught nothing. And I suppose that's what happens sometimes if you're fishing. All night long they've been throwing the net out, pulling it back, peering into the water, looking for bubbles rising at the surface, or whatever it is, and nothing. And again, there's an eyewitness element. Simon Peter, he's taken off some of his garments. He's stripped down because it's hard physical work and he's getting hot. Or maybe it's just because it's all wet and mucky, the work, and he doesn't want to get his clothes ruined. But they fished all through the night, and it's in the morning now. It's they're probably tired. It's probably that kind of chill that you get just before dawn. It's that early morning stillness, the mist maybe hanging on the water, the light's still a bit dim. And then off in the distance, about 100 yards away, there's someone on the shore. And it's like they don't recognize him. He shouts across to them, "Lads, have you got any fish?" Now, if you know anyone who fishes, if you ask them how they got on, how was it? Well, I had a really big one, but it got away, you know? Pride won't let us admit our failings, and if a fisherman's got a really good spot, he's not going to answer that, he's not going to give that away either. But here's Jesus shouting across them, and it is, "Yeah, lads, have you got any fish?" Now, all credit to the disciples. They just shout back, no. I think they're very restrained in the circumstances. Haven't you got any fish? Why don't you like you and find out yourself? Now Jesus gives them this slightly odd instruction. You see, he says they're to cast the net out on the right side of the boat. Now, when you think of boats, you think about them having a rudder at the back, okay, to steer it. But first century boats on the Sea of Galilee didn't have a rudder located at the back. What they had was a steering oar located on the back right quarter. Okay, it's located on the right hand side because then you can sail the boat with your right hand on it, which is your dominant hand. So in order to avoid dangling your nets in it, it's much easier to fish on the left hand side. You see, it's clear. There's nothing there to get in your way. Steer the boat on the right hand side, but you fish on the left hand side. And so Jesus says, fish on the right side, or in other words, fish on the wrong side. And so they pull the dripping monkey net into the boat, but they swap sides. And as is so often the case in the Bible, you see, when Jesus speaks, that's when the story changes. That's when things are transformed. No one ever spoke like this man spoke, says some of the temple guards when they listen to him. It's remarkable, really, that the disciples haven't yet twigged what's going on and who he is, but now Jesus intervenes and he speaks and everything changes. In the sense in which some of us know that in our own lives, don't we? That you never gave Jesus a second thought. You never considered perhaps it was really of any relevance. It wasn't for you. But then for whatever reason, you began to read, you began to think, you began to question, you began to investigate. And as you found, as you were confronted with Jesus in the pages of the Bible, it changed, didn't it? He wasn't just a character in a book. You no longer need to ask who he is. Suddenly it's obvious. It's the Lord. And that's what John shouts out. Suddenly the nets are full. They're too heavy to lift back into the boat. We've got that contrast between Peter and Jesus, the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's John's name that he uses throughout the book for himself. Where John thinks quickly, it's the Lord. Peter acts quickly. Right, I'm off. Boosh. Grabs his robe, ties it round him, or maybe he's somehow adjusted himself, but he's washed into the water. He goes, he's off to see Jesus. And while Peter is splashing his way towards the shore, the rest of them are all straining to tow this flapping, thrashing net full of fish to shore. And when they arrive, there's a barbecue on the beach. Jesus is grilling fish. Jesus has provided bread for them. Breakfast. There is this thing that we came to earlier on in the gospel, that Jesus is the one who sustains. We saw that acted out in John 6 when he fed the 5,000. We saw it, that it was a parable almost, when he described himself as the bread of life. That in order to live, you need to eat me. Jesus is the one who sustains. And yet this is really interesting, because Jesus, having, he's got the fire there, he's got the bread baking, he's got the fish already grilling. Jesus says, why don't you bring some of the fish you've just caught? Now that's interesting, isn't it? Question, is it that Jesus needs their help? Has he turned up, seen them on the shore, on the boat, called them in, but oh no, there are 7 of them. I thought there was only going to be 5. Does he need them to provide fish for him? Well no, of course not. He's sourced the fish already. When he feeds the 5,000, he's able to stretch a handful of fish and some bread to feed that huge crowd. He's the one who's just spoken the word and they've caught the fish. Yet he invites them to bring their fish. Isn't that interesting? We'll mention it more in a moment. And so, what? There's Simon Peter again. He jumps onto the boat, which is now on the shore, and he drags the net ashore. Simon Peter's obviously quite a strong guy. He's quite a physical man. Somewhere along the line, the kind of myth appeared that to be Christian men, you were sort of somehow a little bit feeble, a little bit soft, if you like. And so, at some point along the line, to be really a man in the Christian church, you seem to be a bit floppy, really, like the fish in the net. But actually, here's Peter, a strong man, a physical man, a working man, who takes all the things and drags it in. And what do they do when they pull him in? Well, they count them, don't they? Why? Because they're fishermen. Next time you're in the garage, and you'll see all the kind of the shelf of magazines, and you'll see there are fishing magazines. You ever seen a fishing magazine? So fishing magazines, they're great because they're full of adverts for boilies and carp food and floating things and wriggling things and all the different things you have to catch fish, you see? And there's always pictures in these magazines of some bloke cradling in his arms as if it was a newborn baby, some chub or perch or bass or whatever. This big goggle-eyed fish, and the man's looking smug as you like because he's caught it. And that's what fishermen do. And so they count them. Of course they count them. Look at it. Have you ever seen so many fish? I wonder how many there are. How many do you reckon there are, John? I reckon there's at least 100. There's way more than that. Come on, I'll count them with you. There's 153. In the 21st century, they'd all be there taking selfies and tweeting pictures of this great host of fish. Do you see the naturalness of this? As some of the commentators argue, there must be some sort of special significance to the number. 153 must represent this. I think it represents the number of fish they caught. But now you see, come and have breakfast. None of them dare ask him, "Who are you?" Why? For they knew who it was. They knew who it is. Who else can provide a miraculous catch? Who else can tell them where to fish? Who else can keep the nets from breaking? Who else would meet them like this? You see, in this miracle, there is a kind of parable being worked out. Jesus has already told them that they're going to be now fishers of men. They're going to be working in a new direction. They've got a new purpose. Elsewhere, the other Gospels, he gives them a great mission to proclaim the good news throughout the world, to spread the word, to teach others so that they will become disciples too. Question. Does Jesus need his disciples to do that? Does he need them to go and make more disciples? Could he not do it some other way? Of course he doesn't need them. Like he doesn't need their fish. But here's the wonderful thing. He chooses to involve them in it. He chooses to get them to bring their fish. He chooses to include them in the work of making disciples. What a privilege. You know, back in John 15, Jesus said, "Without me you can do nothing. But if you remain in me, you'll bear much fruit." And that's what's being acted out for us here. Their own fishing, despite all their expertise, despite all night doing it, came to nothing. But with him, it is fruitful. There's a picture then here of that gospel work that he's given to them and he's given to us. We can work hard and we can plan well and we can be in the right place and we can be doing the right things and we can do lots of it. And yet without me, you can do nothing, says Jesus. And it highlights the importance once again of our praying, that our activity on its own will be empty. And so we need his intervention. We need him to speak, which changes everything. Notice the capacity in Luke 5, in the account there of the other miracle where they're fishing and Jesus, they've taken Jesus in the boat so that he can speak from the boat, and then he tells them afterwards to fish, and there their nets are breaking. But here their nets aren't breaking. There's still room for more. And he takes the bread and he gives it to them, and he does the same with the fish. Jesus is sustaining them. This was now the third time that Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. The resurrection, real and physical and literal, not a metaphor, not a spiritual concept. Jesus actually crucified, objectively dead, verifiably buried, and yet physically resurrected. Ghosts don't tend barbecues. Of all these men here on the beach with Jesus, fish rolls for breakfast. It is only John, the author, who would live to a good old age. He would end up on the Isle of Patmos as an old man imprisoned for proclaiming that Jesus was risen. The rest of them would all be executed for stubbornly asserting that Jesus was risen, for not giving up that story, whatever happened to them. They had seen him and they knew it was true, and nothing would shake that from them. Well, that's the first half of the story. And then, just more quickly, I want to just look at the second part. Because I want you to see here the love that Jesus displays. You see, there's a bit of an elephant in the room. The thing that nobody dares to mention. I mean, Peter's excitedly splashing about in the water to get to Jesus. And when Jesus wants fish, it's Peter who rushes to get it. There's something that's not been mentioned. There's something that's not been talked about. There's a bit of a problem, isn't there? Because with all his enthusiasm to get to Jesus, and all this quick grabbing the fish because Jesus wants a fish, it's only just over a week or so, maybe a couple of weeks at most, since Peter had denied ever meeting Jesus. And Jesus had warned him about it, but before the cock crows, you're going to have denied me three times. No, not me. Not me, says Peter. All the rest might leave you, but I never will. And there's Peter rushing in with angels fear to tread as he starts waving his dagger around there in the garden, and he cuts the servant's ear. But when it comes to it, when a little girl says to him, "Weren't you one of them?" "Oh no, not me. Never heard of the fella." How do you deal with that? How do you straighten that out? But you see, Peter is one of Jesus' apostles. He's one of the ones that Jesus is going to send to carry this message. More than that, Peter is going to end up a leader of the apostles. How can they take him seriously? How can he function like that? What to do? There, publicly, Peter had said one thing and done another. Well, and so, for the sake of his usefulness, for the sake of his ministry, not because Jesus needed him, in the same way that Jesus didn't need his fish, but out of his love for him, Jesus is going to reinstate Peter. And just as Peter's failing and falling was in the presence of the other disciples, so now his reinstatement is going to be there in their presence, there within their earshot. After they finished eating, Jesus says to Simon Peter, "Do you love me more than these?" The fire's still smouldering in the background. Is it? I don't want to press too deeply into this. I don't know. But it's interesting. In the New Testament, the word that's used for fire is a different word to this word. The word that's used here is the word for a charcoal fire, like a barbecue. There's only one other place you get charcoal fire mentioned in the Bible. It's the charcoal fire that Peter and the others are standing round to warm themselves in the high priest's courtyard. You know how that evocative thing, how a smell brings back a memory, a place? The smoke from the charcoal. Still smouldering in the background. Still evoking that time, that place. And now Jesus says to Simon Peter, do you love me? Well, you know I love you. Feed my lambs. Simon, do you love me? Well, you know I love you. Take care of my sheep. Simon, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, three times. Just as Peter had denied three times, Peter being given three opportunities to declare his love towards Jesus. You know everything. You know that I love you. And the others are within earshot. John is walking along behind, we discover. He's following on. Jesus, Peter turns and sees him and asks about him. But there, Peter declaring his love. Here's the point. Peter is busy protesting his love to Jesus, who is busy demonstrating his love because he restores him. It's a veiled warning there to his martyrdom that would come up. But there's a reinstatement. Follow me. Like he was told at the first. In all the things that you've done that grieve God. And you have. And I have. And here's Jesus at the end saying what he said at the beginning. Follow me. He's gracious, isn't he? He would receive you back again and again and again. And he has. Well, Jesus invites them to breakfast. You see, this meal they have together is not just, well, they're hungry, they've got to eat. The invitation to a meal is a richer thing. It's not just to fill them up, it's an invitation to fellowship, an invitation to closeness, an invitation to communion, to understanding, to togetherness. Jesus wants to know them and wants them to know him. Because they're like this ragtag bunch of fishermen. And there's nothing special about them. And some of them, we're not even, these seven, we don't even know which ones they were on this day. But Jesus invites them and he loves them and he draws themselves to him. And he's their God and he's their Lord and he's their master and he's their friend. And it's his initiative and he's doing the running here. He's taking the steps. He invites them. And he invites us, doesn't he? To come and meet God. To come and eat with him. To get to know him. To be satisfied. To rest. To be known. To be understood. And here's the invitation. And, you know, when someone invites you to something, you think, oh, are they just doing this because they've got to? Or is this person inviting me because they love me? Because they're concerned about me? Well, as Jesus invites you, how do you know that he loves you? How do you know the invitation is offered in love? Well, he loves you so deeply that he died on the cross in order to save you. Here's a quote from a man called Sinclair Ferguson, Scotsman. When we think of Christ dying on the cross, we're shown the lengths to which God's love goes in order to win us back to himself. Listen now to this, he says. We would almost think that God loved us more than he loves his son. We can't measure such love by any other standard. He's saying, I love you this much. Cross is the heart of the gospel. It makes the gospel good news. Christ died for us. There are people who get things a bit mixed up about these meals that Jesus has with his disciples, about this statement about Jesus being the bread of life in chapter 6. They think that somehow those things are about the Lord's Supper that we come. And they're not. They've got that's back to front. The Lord's Supper is about those things. So we come to the Lord's Supper where it's not that in eating the bread, Jesus gives us life. It's that in eating the bread, we look to him who is the bread of life. It's that in coming together around the table, we are reminded of this invitation to come and be sustained by him, to feast on him, to rest with him, to know him. And so, as I close this, as we move into the next part of the service, I mission you with an invitation. I'm here as Jesus' representative, if you like. Come. Come and have breakfast. Well, come and meet him. Come and know him. Come and be understood by him. Come and be sustained by him. Be fed by him. Come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, he says, and I'll give you rest. So we'll come to the Lord's Supper together.